Good evening. I'm Robert Leonardi, the director of the Economic and Social Cohesion Laboratory of the European Institute. I am not Paul Taylor, the director of the European Institute, who unfortunately had to go, or fortunately for the European Institute, he had to go to Paris to for an inaugural meeting of the joint master's degree that we will be doing with Sciences Po in Paris. So, in fact, this year we have the first class, the entering class for this master's, which is starting in Paris, and then next year they will be here in London. This evening we have the great pleasure of having with us Fabrizio Saccomanni of the EBRD. Mr. Saccomanni is Vice President and Risk Management of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. In his capacity, he is a member of the Executive Committee of the Operations Committee of the Treasury Exposure Committee, in terms of there's the Committee of Committees. His main areas of responsibilities also include environmental protection, nuclear safety projects, and official co-financing operations. In the context of the Stability Pact for Southeastern Europe, he serves as chairman of the Working Table on Economic Reconstruction, Cooperation, and Development. So he's been with the EBRD since February of this year. And before, he was the Director of International Affairs of the Banca d'Italia, and he said to me informally before, he considers himself a central banker. So therefore, I think that we should welcome him and his presentation on the EBRD operations in Central and Eastern Europe. And then also, after his presentation, we will have a question and answer period. Mr. Saccomanni.
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm Fabrizio Saccomanni. I'm not someone else. I'm very happy and indeed honored to have been invited here in this prestigious institution. And I must say, I have not studied here at the London School, but many of my colleagues in the Bank of Italy, where I spent most of my professional life, have indeed studied here. When it was my time to choose where to do some specialized work on international economics and monetary policy, I decided to go to the United States. So I've been in Princeton University, but of course, you know, we have considered the London School as a very important source of inspiration and education for all of us. So I'm very pleased to be here, and I hope I can be sort of in line with the standards of this prestigious institution. I will talk, let me see if I understand how to operate this thing. No? All right. Okay. Well, the subject of my talk tonight is the role of the EBRD in the transition process in Eastern Europe. And the EBRD, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, is the institution where I work, and I've decided to give you at a glance some basic facts about it, and then we will concentrate more on the transition process, which is the interesting aspect. So the bank was founded in 1991 to help the transition to a market economy in the countries of the former socialist bloc, and you know, we have 27 member states, which we consider countries of operation. They are in Central Europe, in Southeastern Europe, and in the Commonwealth of Independent States, which is the name of the former Soviet Union countries. I put the acronyms here because you will see them in the charts and graphs that we'll present later on, so that that is going to facilitate your understanding. The bank is owned by 60 states, among which, in addition to the countries of operation, there are the major industrial countries in the European Union and the other G7 countries, and two intergovernmental organizations, which are the European Commission and the European Investment Bank. We have a capital of 20 billion euro, and at the end of December, we had the total outstanding facilities of 18.4 billion, which means that we have almost utilized all our capital. And since we have a gearing ratio of 1:1, we have to remain at the present level of lending for the foreseeable future in order to retain the AAA rating, which is one of the consequences of having such a strict gearing ratio. As you can see from the numbers I've put on the bottom of the slide, we have over, since the creation of the bank, we have financed over 1,000 projects for a total amount of 22.7 billion euro, and we have mobilized additional resources for almost 46 billion euro. Let me perhaps explain very briefly what is this last figure means. The bank never finances entirely one project with its own money 100%. We finance normally between 25 and 30% of each project, and we try to bring in additional capital, both from other official sources, national governments, donors, as we call them, or other international financial institutions, but mostly from other private investors, commercial banks, and private corporations. So the activity, the size of the activity of the bank has to be measured jointly by what we put of our own money, our own resources, and the money that investors, both from the banking sector and the non-banking sector, are willing to put together in our projects. All right. Okay. Now we are entering into the discussion of what is the transition process. And I think I would like to outline here that our activity is designed to finance projects that meet certain conditions. The first one is obvious, is sound banking. We want our money back, so to speak. We are a bank that has to, we don't have a profit objective, but our shareholders and the major governments don't want us to lose money. So we need to finance projects that make sense from an economic point of view. Then the other condition is additionality. Here there is a need to explain a little bit better what it means. We basically have to finance projects that would not ordinarily be financed by private investors because they are considered a little too risky. So we are not, we have not been founded to compete with the private sector, to give sort of cheap money to certain countries, but since our objective is indeed to promote the transition to a market economy, to create a sort of a market-oriented type of economic activity, structures and enterprises and intermediaries, we have to indeed finance only things that would indeed not be financed by the private sector, and we have to concentrate on this kind of projects that would not ordinarily be financed otherwise. Now, there seems to be, one could argue that there may be a contradiction between the first and the second principle. Why you want sound banking and then you finance projects that cannot be financed by the private sector. Well, I think the contradiction is more apparent than real. The reason is that, you know, for example, the bank, the EBRD, has a privileged creditor status. So if there is a debt crisis in the countries that we are financing, our loans will not be subject to rescheduling or renegotiation. So if a private bank wants to jointly finance a project with us, they would enjoy also the same kind of protection as preferred creditors. And that explains why they would not be able to or willing to finance a certain project alone, but they would be willing to finance it with the EBRD. And so I think we try to determine the soundness of our project by stressing the ability of the countries to indeed, or the companies, because we do finance both sovereign governments and private sector institutions. Then the third condition is that our loans have to have a positive transition impact, and here we will see later on what it means. But I want to clarify here that for each project that we finance, we try to measure in the way that it will be shown in a moment whether this indeed the specific project is indeed such that will improve the transition of the country in itself towards a market economy, towards a market system. And so this is a condition very important for us and is monitored closely by the board of where our shareholders are represented. Then the following condition is the respect for the environment. The EBRD is one of the few international institutions that has specifically in its charter, in its statute, the condition to respect the environment. And so for each project that we finance, we have to make sure that first of all does not damage the environment, which is a minimum requirement for all projects of any kind, of an industrial nature, or in the field of extractive industries, you know, oil, gas, and so forth. But also we want to promote actively projects that indeed improve the environment. One of the legacies past regimes in these countries has been, in fact, a rather consistent neglect of the environment at every level, and so there is a strong need to look at this. And as Bob has indicated, I as responsible for the environmental department, for the nuclear safety, you know, we have quite a lot to do in the field of cleaning up the mess that has been left in the waters and in the gulfs of northern Russia and in the Baltic Sea. And finally, we need to engage with, in any case, even if when we do not finance the government of our member countries, but we finance private sector companies, we want to, in any case, engage with the authorities in a policy dialogue, indicating to them what is our view regarding what they need to do in order to enhance the transition process. Now, I think that the moment has come to define what we mean by transition process. And here is the simple definition: is the development of a market economic system based on private sector development and on the reform of what we consider four ingredients of what constitutes an efficient an efficient market economy, because in order to measure the transition, we have to define where we want to go. And of course, one can define the transition process in many ways, but we have identified four main categories of areas which for constituting elements which we think are essential to establish a market economy system. And I mean, the first one is obviously the market institutions themselves and the regimes that are sort of ruling the domestic trade and international trade. The second component is the enterprise system, namely the set of rules that govern the sort of the undertaking of private economic activities in these countries, where until recently private economic activity was not possible. The third element is what we call the system of infrastructures, and we identify four subsectors, you know, telecoms, electric power, railways, roads, and water and wastewater. And the fourth element is the financial sector, namely the banking and the non-banking sector. Now, for each of these four components, we have developed in the EBRD, but also in conjunction with the World Bank and other specialized monitoring agencies that look at a number of specific aspects. We have developed a set of indicators. Excuse me, I forgot to turn the page. Okay. And and as I said, we use these indicators to monitor the transition at the level of each country in its total activity, and also to monitor, to assess the individual, the transition impact of individual projects. For the understanding of the charts that I will show in a moment, I'll tell you that each indicator uses a measurement scale that goes from 1 to 4+, where 1 means that we are still in the old socialist state, and 4+ means that the country has achieved the standards of an industrialized market economy. And then for each country, we compute a sort of a summary indicator which covers all the indicators. Now, we are going to now to describe very briefly what are the indicators that we used for the category of markets and trade. You know, we look at whether there has been in the country an effective liberalization of prices for the most important commodities, and whether there is indeed a functioning market system. We look at the so-called trade and foreign exchange system, whether trade is free. I mean, people are free to export and import from abroad, and particularly whether they have access to the foreign exchange market, whether they can buy the foreign exchange needed to buy foreign imports, and whether they can keep the proceeds from their exports in order to do international financial transactions. And then we also look at whether in the country there is a competition policy in force. And for competition policy, we mean a policy to avoid abuses of market dominance, and a policy against anti-competitive practices. Now, the second group of indicators regarding the enterprise system, we look at whether there has been the large-scale privatizations have taken place in the key elements of the public sector enterprises, normally that involves public utilities like energy, gas, electricity, but also products like steel or other things. Then we look at whether there has been small-scale privatization at the level of the small and medium-sized enterprises, because we realize that an important element of the transition process is to create in these countries an important structure of small and medium-sized enterprises which are most important for catering to the needs of the of private consumers and households. And then we look at what kind of policies are being adopted in the field of governance and enterprise restructuring, and particularly we look at whether the common practice of subsidizing certain type of production or certain utilities have been indeed eliminated, whether there are effective bankruptcy procedures for companies that are in crisis, and we look at whether what kind of corporate practices are in place. In the infrastructure field, again, we measure, I told you before that we have several sectors, telecom, railroads, railways, so we measure a sort of a composite index, and in order to assess what progress has been made in the field of infrastructure reform, we look at what kind of policies of commercializations have been adopted, whether you know the sale of electricity, for example, or other kind of the access to railways or to roads, you know, has been appropriately commercialized, and we look at whether you know there has been progress in the field of tariff reform, in the field of the regulatory framework that is particularly important in the electricity field, whether there are clear divisions of labor between the production, the distribution of electricity, for example, and the regulatory aspect of the industry, and then what is the involvement of the private sector? Whether you know indeed in the infrastructure the appropriate steps are taken to increase the role of the private sector in the management of again electricity, railroads, and this kind of things. Now the fourth sector where we monitor the transition process is the financial sector, and we look first of all at to what extent there has been reform in the banking system, and in particular the process of liberalization of the formation of the interest rate, whether the interest rate is in the banking system are indeed the result of demand and supply for savings or are sort of artificially administered, and also we look at whether you know there are securities market and non financial institutions that are being developed, and for both indicators we look also at the quality of the regulatory framework and practices, whether there is a supervisory authorities for banks, whether there are supervisory authorities for the equity markets, and also whether there are here it's not fully shown whether there are procedure for resolving illiquidity and insolvency problems in the banks and financial institutions. So these are all the indicators that we monitor, and in our experience we have seen that you know the measures that to carry forward this process of transition are normally going through two different phases, you know, an initial phase of liberalization, which involves most typically the liberalization of the price system and the liberalization in the trade foreign trade and foreign exchange system, and small-scale privatization. That is the sort of the easy part of the transition process, and countries typically have moved in that direction first. Then there is the second phase, which is much more complicated, which we call, going back to the indexes indicators that I've shown, there are the phase of institution building, in which we have reform of the competition policy, reform of the financial sector in the infrastructure field, and also the so-called large-scale privatization. So my point here in concluding this brief presentation of the indicators is that the EBRD, the projects of the EBRD, are affecting practically each of these phases of the process, and each of these aspects, because the bank will normally be present in all process of privatization, both large scale or small scale. We would provide finance either through loans or also through equity, participating in the capital of newly privatized companies. And of course, in our project, we insist on all the measures that I've indicated to carry out restructuring at the enterprise level. If we finance, say, an electricity company, we want to make sure that they sell the electricity at appropriate prices, that the prices are freely determined, and that they do collect sufficient tariffs from their customers. So I think the conditionality that we apply in our loans is present at every level of the of our activity. Now let's look at in a nutshell about what I'm going to show with a number of charts and graphs, which gives an indication of how the transition and economic performance have gone in recent periods. And based on the indicators that I've mentioned, we have seen further progress in reform in 2003, and 14 countries of our 27 have recorded an improvement, and others have remained where they were, and only in two countries there has been some deterioration. Also, economic growth in these countries has continued to outpace the growth rate in global economies, which is a proof that the transition process is indeed leading to an improved economic performance. And then I will go over some of the specific problems that are encountered in a number of countries. Now, this is, as you can see, this is the first graph that summarizes the performance I mentioned. As you can see, that there have been indeed, this is the graph measures the improvement in the global transition indicator for the countries that are listed here. And the countries that have recorded more progress are countries in the Balkans, Serbia, Montenegro, and Bosnia-Herzegovina, and then also Latvia and Russia have made certain progress. The others, there is a group of countries that have made more modest progress. And then, the two countries that have gone backwards are Moldova and Uzbekistan. this again, this other graph shows that if you see the countries that are marked with the yellow bars, these are the countries that will become member of the European Union in this year, in May 2004. And as you can see, there are between 3 and less than 4, so they're very close to the 4+ level, which indicates, as I said, the market economy standards, but they're not there yet. And if you look at some of the specific indicators that I mentioned, you see that there are still quite a lot of progress to be made. And then, as you can see, this the performance of the other major grouping of countries in Southeastern Europe and in the Commonwealth of Independent States. Now, I'm going to show you an interesting graph, which is well analyzed in the transition report, because I forgot to tell you that the bank produces every year a transition report in which we provide all the information I'm trying to summarize here, you know, country by country, sector by sector, in which we did indeed want to provide a full account of what is going on. Now here we try to establish a linkage between transition and political liberalism. And together with the help of various other institutions like the World Bank and certain independent watchdogs of developments in these countries, we have created this index of constitutional liberalism, which includes an indicator that covers, you know, the implementation of the rule of law, the protection of property rights, the control of corruption, and freedom of the media. And this index ranges from 0 to 1, and you can see it on the left axis. And here it shows clearly that there is indeed a correlation that the countries that have made more progress in the transition, which is measured on the horizontal axis here, are indeed the countries that have higher ratings in terms of protecting those rights. And a similar conclusion shows that the process of reform, which is measured here by the transition index here, in order to make the comparison possible, we have scaled the transition indicator from 1 to 4 to 0 to 1, so that we have the constitutional liberalism index and the reform. And you can see that where the transition has been, there is more liberalism, indeed the progress in the transition has been higher. But then I'll move quickly on on the economic performance, and you can see that all groups of countries in the area of operation of the EBRD have indeed recorded strong growth performance in 2002 and 3 and also in 2004. That is the outlook. And if you compare with the Eurozone, of course the comparison is very humbling for the European Union. The United States are doing better, but still, these countries are growing at a stronger rate. And now the next, this progress in growth has been accompanied by good performance on the field of inflation, where you see strong progress has been made, particularly in the countries of Central Europe and the Baltics, but also in Southeastern Europe, less so in the former Soviet Union. Stock markets, I don't have a chart for stock markets, but stock markets have also had a very good performance in these countries, and which is also partly reflected by this chart, which shows that these are estimated data for 2003, there's been a very good performance of of as far as capital inflows, particularly foreign direct investment. Although, and here we show another chart, in 2003, if you look at detail of the situation in particularly in details of the subgroup of countries, you see that in the central European and Baltic states there has been a decline in foreign direct investment, while there has been an increase in investment for natural resources in the former Soviet Union countries. But now let's look at what are the main challenges that are confronted with this group of countries. You see, for the countries which are part of the so-called accession group, the key issue is here that they do have a fiscal balance or a budgetary problem, which is quite serious, particularly if one looks at the 3% target for the Maastricht treaty criterion. You know, some of these countries are, and particularly the most important countries in Central Europe, like Hungary, the Czech Republic, Poland, are all indicating their willingness to join the euro area at a relatively early stage, and while they're showing in some cases very dangerously high deficits. Now, you have to understand that these countries, in order to really join the eurozone, will have to achieve a degree of economic flexibility which is quite important. Consider, for example, that in most of these countries, even those who are becoming member of the EU, there are still a lot of investments to be made in infrastructure, in the environmental sector, and these investments will probably have to be financed by the public sector. So if the public sector already before accession shows this kind of important deficits, that is indeed a big problem. In Southeastern Europe, the big problem is that they have to integrate further with the European Union. They are a little behind, and they have to be able to attract foreign direct investment to replace official flows. As you can see, in most of these countries, the large amount of inflows are due to private remittances, mostly emigrants who are sending money back home, and official flows, but the foreign direct investment, which is the sort of dark yellow bar, is indeed very small. And this shows that these countries are unable to attract what is called the greenfield investment, new investment particularly in small and medium-sized enterprises. And finally, the challenges for the countries of the former Soviet Union is we have particularly identified the case of the so-called resource-rich countries, which are mostly Russia, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan, countries that are rich in oil and gas resources, where they have a lot of exports from oil and gas. So they have important revenues coming from these sources. And there is a risk that in these countries we will have what is called the Dutch disease. You know, once they were in the Netherlands, you know, they were all getting a lot of money from exports of gas, and so they were not really paying attention to making the country more competitive in the other sectors. And this is indeed a problem which is confronting these countries, because, you know, the oil price could go down and they would then be confronted with a lot of unresolved problems in their economies. I would like to conclude briefly by saying a few words on what on what do we, what are the conclusions that we've reached, particularly in this year transition report, on how to achieve further progress in transition. And basically, we think that the recipe is indeed integration and regional cooperation. The 4 points that are basically noted here is that the progress towards trade and capital market integration into the world economy has been going forward, but is not completed. And we see, for example, this is a very interesting chapter of our report, where there is also an interesting analysis of based on so-called gravity models, in which we show that these countries indeed do trade with the rest of the world, but much less than they could, based on the traditional parameters, based on the level of incomes and location. So there is a need to explain why these countries are trading less than they could, and the explanation is again the lack of integration and structural impediments, and on which I will return in a moment. And then we see the problem with foreign investment, which there's been a lot of it, but has been concentrated mostly in the so-called accession countries and in the extractive industries. And also, I will add here on a few cases in which there have been large privatizations, in the sense that there has not been a sort of a constant sustainable flow of foreign investment. There has been more occasional investment when there has been privatization of telecoms in one country or another. Then there has been a lot of inflow, then privatization finished, you know, there is no more money because there is not indeed enough economic activity, economic private investment. And then we also have noted that another indicator of economic integration is labor mobility, and we see that there's been no massive migration from these countries towards Western Europe, as someone had feared initially. And in fact, there is indeed very limited mobility even within at the regional level. I think the report is not a policy recommendation, but we basically point to a few area for further reflection. And certainly in the field of trade, there is certainly on the part of the European Union, there is a need to open better its market to these countries. You know, the report shows in great detail that even though some trade barriers have been lifted in general, if you look at the specific categories of products, for example, meat in Moldova, you see that there is a protection of 100% in the European Union. So there is zero export of meat from Moldova to the European Union because the tariff is prohibitive. So I think that is number one. I think we need to really to make an effort to open our markets to these countries. Otherwise, it's difficult to preach trade liberalization only for them, and why we are protectionist. I think the evidence shows that there is indeed a sort of a virtuous circle between improved market access and the process of structural and institutional reforms. As you open your economies, you know, people begin to own their own businesses, their own companies, and so become more resolute in their demands for less interference by the government in economic activity and instead greater efforts at reform. And then again, you know, closer regional cooperation is extremely important. My experience in the Stability Pact for Southeastern Europe, which Professor Leonardi was mentioning before, shows that this is indeed important. We have been creating a network of free trade agreements among all the countries in the Balkans, and that is indeed creating a virtual free trade area among countries of former Yugoslavia, which are coming after 10 years of hostilities against each other, and they have to rediscover integration and cooperation. Again, on capital, labor, capital and labor flows, there is a need to improve the climate for foreign direct investment. And again, the policies that are adopted to facilitate trade are also useful for creating a positive climate for foreign direct investment. You know, the point I always make is that in some of these countries, which are relatively small, it will be impossible to create incentive for investment, even if you give them subsidies or tax rebates, unless you offer the foreign investor the ability to export within the whole region. So we cannot have a large investment in Croatia or in Uzbekistan unless, you know, the company that is established there is allowed to export to the neighboring countries. And most of these countries are still almost landlocked, in the sense that they have their desire to get rid of the past has also led to the interruption of trade among countries that participated in the group of the so-called COMECON. And then, you know, there is a need indeed to increase mobility in the labor market, addressing the problem in the housing market, lack of information. But in both these areas, you know, we need to move with gradualism, because investment can also be of a very volatile type, and labor mobility can also result in a brain drain. Those who are mobile are those who are better qualified, the young, and there is a risk of really reducing the ability of these countries to compete. So finally, and I think I've remained more or less within my 45 minutes, I would like to say that the conclusion is that the transition is a reform-driven process. You know, that we are confident with the evidence of all our transition reports that we have prepared over the years, is that indeed without reform it's impossible to activate the sort of stimuli for transition. And you know, the key issue is that, you know, reform indeed create the scope for development of trade and investment, you know, create a structure conducive to private sector investment, to business activity. The process is not completed, certainly not in the countries of the former Soviet Union. Even in Russia, there is a strong stimulus to reform and to private sector activity concentrated in the key cities of Moscow and St. Petersburg. But Russia is indeed a gigantic country, and in some of the more faraway regions, you know, the process of transition is still in an early stage. And then, as I said at the beginning, the EBRD can play a catalytic role, because we can mobilize finance from private investors, from other institutions. We get funds from the European Union. We cooperate with the European Investment Bank, with the World Bank. And indeed, through our conditionality and the emphasis on transition, we do believe that we do make a change. We make a difference in this country. Thank you very much.
I would like to open up with the questioning period by asking the first question. The increases in GDP scores that you've shown, quite impressive for the southeastern European and Baltic countries for the former Soviet Union, et cetera. And then you've also discussed the economic problems that they've had. How much of this is really sort of recuperating what they had lost in the transition period from a command economy to a market economy? Because in the accession states to the European Union in the period between 1989 and 2002, we saw that in the first 4 or 5 years there was economic downturn or economic collapse or a reduction in the size of the economy. And then in the period after 1995, there was this return, and now most of them have returned to where they were and have gone beyond that. What about in the countries that you have listed here?
Well, the situation is obviously different from in different groups of countries. Certainly, you know, if we make a comparison between two groups of countries, you know, which are have gone through quite different experiences, the countries of Central Europe and the countries of Southeastern Europe, you know. The transition period for this first group of countries started in 1990. And as you said, there has been a period in which following the initial phase of liberalization, there were sort of major losses in economic activity and so forth. But at the end of the decade, you know, I think the countries have not only recuperated this initial fall, but I think they were a level which were far higher than the sort of the socialist period. In the countries of Southeastern Europe, on the other hand, since the decade of the 90s basically has been lost through internal strifes and war and conflict, they have indeed gone much worse than they were before, you know, and they have they are just beginning now at the end of the 90s with the new century, the new millennium, that they are indeed catching up. The countries that have shown a greater degrees of progress, like Serbia, Montenegro, and Bosnia and Herzegovina, they start from a very low level, and that explains why progress has been more visible. But it is encouraging. But still, you know, on the whole, these countries suffer very large rates of unemployment. And indeed, that unfortunately is reflected also in the resumption of political uncertainties, you know, lack of support for a reform program, or a certain degree of fatigue in the adjustment process, in which is shown again in certain performances which are not very very positive.
Okay, for questions from the audience, we have someone with a microphone, so that if you and when you ask the before asking the question, could you please identify yourself? Elisabetta Berter, member of our staff.
Yeah, Elisabetta Bertero, I'm also the LSE, like Bob. Well, my question is, what would you say about a comparison of the IMF conditionality and EBRD conditionality? I mean, with respect to the IMF conditionality, there's been a wide debate on issues such as country ownership. And I wonder whether, with respect to the EBRD, perhaps because your loans are so project-based, that the issue doesn't arise, maybe. But what is your view? Yeah. Thanks.
Well, I would say that the main difference is that the IMF conditionality is mostly of a macroeconomic nature, while ours is mostly project-related. You know, the two should not be in conflict, and in fact, we certainly would not, for example, encourage large borrowing program in a country by the state economy, by the state in a country where there is a sort of a a ceiling on public sector borrowing, which is imposed as part of the macroeconomic conditionality of the IMF. But at the same time, you know, we, as I've briefly explained, you know, we try to impose a conditionality which shows, I mean, is able to elicit the transition impact. Perhaps I will make one example. You know, we do finance in many countries. Sorry,
I'm trying to switch on the light.
Oh, okay.
No, I think it's here.
All right.
I think it's back there.
We finance banks, and we do it. You know, we extend credit lines to banks, or we participate in the privatization of banks. Yeah. Or found new banks in some of these countries. Now, whenever we do that, you know, we ask as a condition that the banks do make loans to the private sector. So that is the conditionality. We want to make sure that a newly created bank in a country where, you know, only the big state corporations were receiving financing from the banks, also the small private sector are able to obtain financing. And so we oblige the banks, perhaps it's my telephone, I don't know, but we'll try to kill it. And these are the kind of conditionality that we would impose based precisely on this kind of transition indicators that I mentioned, and or as I mentioned, we finance railroads or restructuring of a railroad company, our conditionality would be based, you know, how much are you going to pay, I mean, to have, you know, passengers or users of electricity to pay, and whether this is remunerative and so forth. These are the kind of conditionality that we impose, and so there is basically, I mean, our conditionality is generally much more welcomed than the IMF conditionality, because I mean, there is an obvious value added. You know, we sometimes our conditionality is most often associated also with grants. You know, we have donors' money given to us, and sometimes we finance training programs for bank staff, for managers of electricity companies, and so forth. So they appreciate the fact that we do bring in a certain value added and additional resources.
Yes.
I'm Shruti, and I'm a student at LSE. Sir, I would like to ask how much of the effort of EBRD is focused towards development of human capital directly in, say, educational or health or poverty alleviation programs?
Yeah. Well, we are not allowed in our charter to finance specifically this type of projects. For example, we cannot finance the construction of a school or a hospital. You know, this is supposed to be done by other international institutions. Our mandate is to, as I said, to create the structures of a private sector, of a private market economy. But as I just said, you know, we do pay a lot of attention indirectly to the formation of human capital. And in practically all projects that we finance, there is always an element of training, of formation of staff and in a number of practices, you know, moving, you know, from the ability to assess the credit risk at small and medium-sized enterprises, you know, rural development, and so forth. But these are part, I would say, are the complementary parts of a project whose aim is to create a new private sector business, not not the kind of social type of investment in education or schooling and so forth. But we do, as I said, manage to indirectly to do quite a lot in this in this field.
So it's much more project specific rather than general.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I was a student. There is a big difference in between the portion of foreign direct investment in the Eastern European countries and the CIS. Does EBRD understanding and realizing that there is a kind of Dutch disease in central in CIS countries, does EBRD provide some kind of project advice or project analysis?
Well, as I said, we are trying to indeed finance in those countries which are rich in natural resources to develop additional sectors of the economy, and we are involved for example, in Russia, in a very large number of projects which are non-oil or non-energy related, and that is an important share of our activity. But still, in comparison with the size of the oil sector, which we do not particularly finance, you know, as you probably know, there is a strong opposition, in fact, from non-governmental organizations, you know, towards these projects which are seen as damaging the environment and so forth. So we do participate in the in this kind of energy related projects precisely to protect the environment. So we normally are, for example, investing together with British Petroleum in one project which goes through Azerbaijan, Georgia, and brings oil to the Mediterranean. And our assignment within this group is not to bring a lot of money, because, I mean, the oil companies do not need our money, but we have been asked by the host governments to participate in this project to make sure that, you know, the environment is protected. So what we are going to are sort of environmental protection aspects of this overall project. But as I said, you know, we are very much involved also in other sectors, and we do provide project financing in a variety of sector, you know, from consumer goods to intermediate capital goods for wood. Furniture factories, refrigerators, all sorts of things.
There's a question down here.
I think there was also some question.
The questions are starting to bloom.
Bartol Cech is from the European Institute of the LSE. Following up from what you just said, I would be interested in what discount rate the EBRD uses for its cost-benefit analysis of project. We discussed that a lot in some of our courses, because obviously for the political economy of transition and integration, it may be very important, or enlargement,
yes,
what kind of discount rate you use, and a net benefit may turn into a net cost depending on how high that rate is. So the first question is, what rate does the EBRD use and for what reason? And secondly, relating to environment, what rate do you use? Do you use it, use a rate that takes into consideration environmental concerns? Because obviously, if you use a market rate, a high rate, that gives the market signal to exploit the natural resource very fast, and therefore has an environmental impact. I think a technical point that is often overseen by World Bank and other donors.
Yeah. Well, this is would require an additional conference. I would say that we tend to be rather pragmatic in our assessment of the project. Typically, projects are originated in what we call the banking department, and the banking department is very careful in identifying projects that would basically be economically sound. And in some cases, you know, these projects are considered to be not not very meaningful in terms of transition impact. So then the project is sort of channeled through a rather severe scrutiny in which all these aspects, you know, the internal rate of return, the transition impact, you know, and also the assessment of the risks, you know, I'm as head of risk management at the bank, we want to make sure that you know, we do not undertake too sort of excessive risks, and we do not finance things that are not going to be repaid. So I would say that at the end, the final decision whether to finance or not is I would say negotiated between I would say the banking department, the chief economist office, the risk management function, in which, you know, the various elements that are you know, part of our activity is are assessed, and then we have an ex post evaluation conducted by an independent department of the bank, which after 2 or 3 years looks at whether this project I mean has gone well, whether it has, you know, the results have been achieved, and whether the money has been repaid, and but most importantly whether the transition impact that was estimated ex ante to be positive, because, you know, that is a condition for all our project, whether it has been achieved also ex post. And here, of course, we have different different cases, you know, and basically, you know, we in terms of the kind of rate of interest rates that we apply to our project, this is you know, indeed carefully assessed in order to achieve this balanced equilibrium in the sense between our constraints and our goals. We cannot compete with the private sector. We cannot give cheap money to develop certain type of activities, you know, or to give an incentive to the development of certain activities. But at the same time, we don't want to overburden, you know, the country with because we are not our motivation is not primarily profit, but we want to make sure that you know the country, I mean the project is appropriately priced, you know, and we do get the right balance between these various elements of that enter into the picture. It's a highly pragmatic type of exercise more than model based, and we have always, as I said, since we don't finance entirely a project, but we do have to bring in the private sector, although at certain conditions, you know, that is indeed a constant reminder of whether we are sort of within the right track or not.
There's a question here. Right, this one.
Julius Eckert, student at the European Institute. I'm interested in the role of policy dialogue that you mentioned at the beginning, but more in the reverse way. Is there any role for the EBRD as a facilitator in negotiations with the Commission, for example, about trade issues? You mentioned trade issues on certain agricultural products, for example. Is there any role for the EBRD in that direction?
Well, yes. I think we, as I mentioned, perhaps very briefly, the European Commission gives us money that we, I mean, grant money, money that does not have to be repaid, that we can use to support the projects that are identified and evaluated by us. It is, and some of this grant money that we receive and we associate with our project goes in most of the cases towards achieving these transition objectives I mentioned to. Now, we are negotiating with the European Union when they give us money, you know, and we tell them what we want to do with their money. And indeed, we have a very, very, I would say, intense and sometimes heated debate, you know, with them. I would not consider that we can indeed change the course of the policies of the European Union. But certainly, we have. We make our voice heard, you know, on a number of issues, and we use this period in which we negotiate with the European Union on their contributions to our activity, which in a way one would say, well, we are on the demanding side because we are asking for money. But that is not entirely true because the European Commission cannot do everything by itself. You know, so they have a certain amount of money that they are obliged to give away because they cannot follow directly from Brussels projects in the very wide spectrum of sectors that we cover. So they have to give us money, and we are telling them, look, you know, here we want to. For example, set up a trade facilitation project, you know, in which we provide financing for exports of by small and medium-sized enterprises, and we tell them, look, you know, you better remove the tariffs on this type of commodity because this is in fact will make our efforts at trade facilitation totally pointless if this. Countries don't have an access to the European market. Now, the example I made with Moldova before is indeed unfortunate because Moldova is a country which is somehow in between. It's not part of the accession countries. It's not part of the Balkans, and it has been somewhat neglected also because from a political point of view, the political situation there is not. Is not simple, but we do indeed sort of engage in a very strong policy dialogue, not only with the European Commission, but also with the European Investment Bank and the World Bank. You know, in a lot of operations, we operate 50-50, for example, with the International Finance Corporation, which is the private sector development arm of the World Bank, and so you know, together with this. Network of contacts and debates. I think we are indeed fostering the cause of opening up markets. Unfortunately, these are issues that are highly politicized, also in the West, and then you end up with disasters like Cancun, and no one really knows how it came about. You know, but. It came about, and it was wrong, and it has to be reversed. You know, so each voice counts on this.
Okay, three more questions. There's the gentleman here. There's here, and then there's the gentleman on the left-hand side.
Yeah, it's Paul Wilson from SunGard, a company called SunGard. I think I'm right to say that the Russian default crisis was quite a problem. For EBRD, and I'm interested to know the 99 Russian default was quite a difficult time. I'm interested in your risk management process. Is it more country-specific, project-specific, and how would you sort of give metrics to different projects?
Yeah. Well, certainly the Russian crisis was a problem for the bank. We indeed. I was not at the EBRD at that time, but we indeed incurred losses, but less than it was to be expected, because I think it is important to recall that thanks to the so-called preferred creditor status that the bank enjoys. In fact, all the sovereign loans that we had made to Russia or to public sector entities were not affected by the default. There was an initial period in which we did not hear precise indications from the Russian side, in which they said, no, all is covered, the all loans, and then we explained to the Russians that this would be a tragic mistake, because if they would sort of default on loans from international institutions like the EBRD, that would have a very negative impact on the market. So eventually, our losses were mostly from the private sector loans, particularly to the small banks, some of which we had financed, some of the early equity funds that had purchased shares of small companies and so forth. But that was not quantitatively very, very big, and it was easily absorbed by our reserves and so forth. And also some of those who have operations that had become non-performing at that time, they're subsequently regained their status as performing loans. So on the whole, it was not a tremendous shock. It was certainly a very difficult period, but I think we managed to get through it. Now, we do assess risk both on a country level. We have our own internal risk rating for all countries based on our own analysis, and of course on sort of our understanding of what is the market view of in terms of the rating agencies and so forth. But we also rate each project again with a ranking in terms of riskiness, and so our decision is normally the combined result of the two. But I mean, you know, the life of the risk manager is never quite life. You know, I mean, we have just discovered that, you know, we have had our own little impact through the recent default of Parmalat, you know, an Italian company that had nothing to do with the EBRD, because but then we discovered that certain companies that we had financed, you know, are in fact owned by Parmalat. So, I mean, in Hungary, in Russia, and in Romania. So, you know, risks tend to materialize, you know, in very strange places and random way. So, it is a constant monitoring that is required. But on the whole, as I said, you know, the bank has a very low level of non-performing loans. Out of the total of nearly $20 billion, we have less than $500 million of non-performing loans, and which includes loans that we are in the process of negotiating with some sort of exit strategy or recovery or workout procedure. So this is not the equivalent to losses, and I think on the whole, you know, considering the fact that we are obliged almost by our statute to invest in a relatively restricted group of countries, we're not like the World Bank that is financing the world, you know, but we are financing only 27 countries, which are in a relatively uniform situation, although with all the differences that we have outlined, you know. But what was the problem in 97 was that there were the correlations between the shocks was very high, in the sense that through the banking system, you know, international portfolio managers, you know, they put all transition countries all in the same risk category, you know, I mean, the Polands and the Russias and the Hungary and so, which was not correct, of course, you know, but it's very difficult in time of crisis to preach sort of diversified type of strategy. The the immediate response goes by indeed great categories of groupings in which, you know, sometimes they make a distinction between a sort of transition or regional, but sometimes, you know, they take all the category of emerging markets, you know, from Russia to India to China to, which of course is a mixed bag of very different situations. Can you speak louder, because I cannot hear you well.
How does EBRD help improve corporate governance, which help companies with ideas
and Yeah, I got the point about corporate governance, but the last part...
Does it help IPOs?
IPOs issued bonds?
Yeah.
Issued bonds, Parmalat. Should have given Parmalat some help.
Yes, I think, as I said, you know, corporate governance is an important part of our activity. And for example, you know, whenever we finance a company, we, in most cases, demand as a precondition to have, for example, certain audited financial accounts. So, which in many cases. Is something that is not readily available in many of these cases, because they that's where we bring in this sort of grant money that we have in one of our pockets, and we say, all right, we'll pay for your for the certification of your accounts, provided that you learn how to do it, you know, and you establish a proper accounting. Systems and so forth. So in most cases, you know, the corporate governance in these countries is not so much whether there is a sort of, you know, minority shareholders are protected, whether there is a sort of a remuneration committee in the board, but whether, you know, they pay taxes and there is a proper accounting, and there is a separation between the accounts of the entrepreneur and the company and this kind of thing. So it is in many cases a rather difficult and expensive job to do, but we are willing to do it and putting money from our donors, because it has a tremendous significance, you know, for these countries to start sort of looking at their internal governance in a proper way. In many cases, as I said, this is not done at all. So obviously, in the more advanced countries, particularly in Central Europe, where, you know, financial markets are beginning to develop, you know, we are sort of ready to help these companies or that we finance to develop advanced techniques of financing. We tend to provide loans or we buy equity. We don't buy their bonds or things like that. But we do help them, you know, particularly in the case of privatizations. You know, we do participate. We buy our share, and one aspect that is important is that our activity is normally limited in time, in the sense that we become shareholders of a company. We cannot remain shareholders forever. So we have to have an exit strategy, and the exit strategy implies that we have to sell those shares either to a strategic investor or in the market. And you know, we've recently sold part of our share in a major bank in Poland, which we had help to privatize, and this was done with sort of Polish financial institutions. So I think the bank can make an impact, you know, when it gets in, but also when it goes out, in the sense that it can indeed teach how to manage, you know, the exit of a relatively large share of, amount of capital, which can have an impact on the liquidity, on the and then, you know, in some cases, like we are doing in Russia, we have been negotiating, you know, the bank is also planning to issue its own bonds in local currency, which, you know, again, is an issue which is seen sometimes in different ways, in the sense that the authorities sometimes are afraid that if a AAA creditor like the EBRD goes into their financial market, that would be detrimental for their own issuing of government bonds, you know, but we were trying to tell them that this is not the case, that, you know, in each mature market you have to have sort of bonds of the AAA and different ratings, and, you know, a good well-functioning markets has to have all type of instruments, and so we are making progress, and and we are negotiating, you know, with countries also this type of projects, quote unquote. You know.
The last question. Wait over there.
My name is Craig Otto, and I work as an economic analyst, and I'm also studying economics. I have two questions, if I can ask them.
Yeah.
Firstly, what is the bank's policy in regard to debt forgiveness? And I'm thinking in particular about the case of a country where the quantum of the debt burden would perhaps affect that country's transition toward being a market economy. And secondly, what is the bank's strategy for dealing with lending activities in countries where information may be, or the dissemination of information may be unreliable and infrequent?
Your two questions were three, in fact. our policy vis-à-vis debt forgiveness is that we are unforgiving. No, I mean, jokes aside, you know, we, as I said, we try to avoid that type of situation. When we are confronted with it, we try to negotiate a workout which would allow us to take a certain amount of loss that is not. That is not crippling for us, and try to perhaps look at the sort of medium term sustainability of the borrower. I'm talking mostly of private sector borrowing, you know, that we're talking about, in which, you know, there are companies that have had problems, and so we are not unwilling to restructure the indebtedness. As I've said, you know, the only case of sovereign uncertainty we have had was in connection with Russia in 97-98, and we solved that in the sense that the Russian authorities did not request a renegotiation of our debt with us. They are renegotiating their indebtedness towards national governments, towards the banking system within the so-called creditors club, you know, the Paris club for the sovereign debt, and the London club for the banking debt. So we certainly, you know, thinking of the question before about the conditionality, these are mostly issues that are dealt with by the macroeconomic institutions like the IMF. You know, they do express a view about whether, you know, the debt burden is bearable or not, or whether there is a need to go into debt forgiveness. We, as I said, look at it more from let's say a corporate point of view. I mean, it depends on the situation of the single borrower, and certainly we consider them as clients. You know, we don't want to lose them. You know, so if they have a problem, we try to solve it. You know, and keep them afloat. You know, and so from this point of view, it's again an ongoing effort, which is also part of our more general policy dialogue that we have with these countries. But one general point that I would like to make is that because these countries did not have very large access to international capital markets, they are not generally over-indebted. You know, with the possible exception of the former Soviet Union, which in the last a few years, you know, indeed had incurred a lot of debts, but mostly it incurred the debts, in the initial phase of the transition, when there was perhaps excessive recourse to international capital markets and so forth. But apart from Russia or the former Soviet Union itself, you know, the other countries do not have large foreign debt. I mean, Ceausescu in Romania, he was boasting the fact that, you know, the country had no foreign debt, that he had repaid all the foreign debts, which was true, and he had other problems, you know, but not that one. So we don't, as a bank, you know, we don't feel we operate in an area where we have a major problem of that forgiveness. That is mostly the case in other areas of the developing countries, mostly in Africa and in certain parts of Asia, but not in Eastern Europe.
Good. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Saccomanni. And I think we have exploited your knowledge, your intelligence, and your experience to the hilt. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.